Welcome to another episode of North American Deer Talk, where the fusion of facts and opinions become the education and entertainment for all. This is your host, Josh Newton, and we have another great show for you today. Welcome back, everyone. Josh Newton here with another episode of North American Deer Talk. I had the chance to come down and visit with a previous guest, Jared Berry. Jared, how are you?
Good. How are you?
All right. So at this point in time, you're our most frequented guest. You've been on the show three times. I'm not sure if we're going to go off the air because of that or not.
Here, wait, hold on.
But
okay, now.
So it is after 10 a.m. So we are cracking a couple beers and going to sit and have a conversation. But I had to come down here. We're in the Powder Ridge Outfitters lodge. We got a fire going, so it's a good setting for a conversation. I was heading down here today and I was thinking about like winter feeding, and you know, we've talked about hay and you know the importance of good quality hay and why. And then I was also thinking about how deer are interesting, where they like you'll watch them. You have like $500 a ton feed, and you have like this expensive Western hay, and then you watch them walk over to a tree, paw up the ground, and start chewing on the roots. And I think it exposes perhaps something that is kind of inherent in whitetail deer, and that's a good pour. Jared just worked over a nice pour on a Guinness. I'd say just about perfect. Anyway, so they walk over to this tree and they start chewing on stuff, and we miss this change that goes on inside the deer. And I was thinking about what types of things can we add to our feed regimens that help whitetails in the winter. And I did a quick video on my Instagram about apple branches. And
today.
If you have an apple orchard that's close by, you know, in February, they're usually doing their tree trimmings. And I remember early on at my uncle's place, his whole farm was built basically on the side of an old orchard, and we'd go trim branches
specifically for that,
and we'd throw them in the deer pen, and you'd watch them. They would literally attack those things, and all the ends with all the buds and everything, of course, they chew those off. But the bigger branches that were, you know, maybe over half inch that they couldn't, like, chew through, they would chew the bark right off.
Just chew on.
And you come back in a couple days and you have these, like, perfectly polished tree branches. Yeah. And I was thinking, like, what other types of things can we add to feed that are kind of readily available, you know, in the woods or wherever, that deer really like and has some, you know, good nutritional value. I mean, I think they probably get bored, you know, hanging out. They want to chew on some, but I thought the apple branch thing was a really good thing to do.
So. Well, I think a little bit it speaks to diversity in their diet, and in a breeding pen situation, there's not near as much diversity as what they can choose from as if you are managing wild deer property for wild deer or land.
It's like no diversity
or preserve like we have here, where we have that diversity. You know, we have our timber management, we have our food plots, we have our supplemental feed. They can just walk around and whatever they want to browse on, they can. So I used to your point, is there a specific reason you are talking about apple trees, or is it just the access you had and the access that in this time of year works. You have the availability to go get it at an orchard if you're close by, or is it just, or is there a specific reason you're talking about apples?
Well, so I think about the other
apple trees.
Yeah, so I think about the other fruit species that we have here in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. So what do you got? You got pear, peach, cherry. That's about it, right? Am I missing something?
Yeah, but I'm not under. What's your point?
So my point is you ever look at a like cherry bark or like pear bark or peach mm-hmm. tree? They're all rough.
Yeah,
they're all
true.
Rough.
Yeah,
and apple doesn't seem to be that way. I suspect the further out on the branch you go with the other trees, they are softer. I just know that the deer love them.
Yeah, so I've.
I mean, they'll strip them down. They love them.
You've.
So that's why I said it.
Yeah, so I've. And I'm realizing a thing I've lacked on here in the last few weeks, but I used to be, and I should continue to be consistent at least a few times a week. I used to trim oak saplings, oak branches off of you go up my driveway. We timber cut that in 2007, so we're 13 years into that. But all those 3-4-inch saplings, I just take a pole saw and start hacking branches down.
There's a ton of them.
If one's hanging over my driveway, knock that down, and I just load the Ranger up, or the Kubota, whatever I'm using, and just throw a few in each pen. And the same thing happened. That's why I was asking if you were specific.
You do that in the winter?
I should, yes. I don't do it as often as I used to. Mm. Fault of my own.
Yeah.
You know. Regardless, every time I did it, they're coming up and knocking those buds off, you know, and they're chewing a little bit in the branches. Same thing, you know, we and my dad's good at this because I know he'll listen to this, but he'll cut a lot of trees and branches down in the spring, summer, or growing season, and he'll just, even sometimes he'll grab, you know, a 3-4-inch tree, he'll just cut it down, hook a chain to it, and drag it into the pens, mm-hmm. and let those does and fawns chew on it for, you know, until it's gone, and that doesn't take long. So there's something where, to your point, there's a reason they're doing that. I don't know exactly what it is, you know, sure. scientifically, but to walk past that feed that you know has everything they need into it, and they'll chew and eat that tree. They'll stand there for 20 minutes just picking at it.
Right.
I think that even with the alfalfa this time of year, they would still do that. So I don't know. It's just a something different for them, but I think diversity in their diet is important. I don't think we have enough of it in our pens.
Right.
Not that the deer don't do well. They do great on alfalfa and feed. They perform great. Good. So if the only reason you're doing it is because you feel like it's a treat for your deer, I still think you should do it because it's not like us eating a chocolate right. bar. It's good for them. You
know? Yeah. I think what prompted that, now that I think about it, when I was heading out of my place, and I saw someone had a Christmas tree on their front porch. And it's not uncommon for Christmas trees to go into a deer pen.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure. There's a couple of them that they won't touch. I don't know. It's some variety of spruce or pine or whatever. And there's some that they'll eat on it. You know, they'll clean it up. And, of course, I suspect that, you know, large amount of whatever,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
conifer is, yeah. is probably not the best for them, but they're wired to eat that stuff in the winter.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, now do we, by doing so, are we...
Like walk, not to interrupt you, yeah. but just take a walk around a hemlock grove if you have it around your place or any your farm or your property, wherever yep. you live, state game lands down yep. the road. Go find some hemlocks when there's a couple feet of snow on the ground and there's a browse line around
yep.
them.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's just going to your point about pine trees. Now, they won't touch a white pine or a spruce or right. this, but not saying they won't, but they're probably not. They're probably struggling if they are.
Yeah. No, I like, we're fortunate. We got a bunch of hemlocks. Of course, they're starting to die, but
yeah, right.
They,
right, right.
I've covered that ad nauseum. My love for the hemlock tree because it's a good when the bug's not killing a good hardy tree for a deer pen. I think, you know, shade, food, bucks can rub on it. Yep. You know, it's a good tree.
Yep. I don't want to cut, but another reason you see guys pull, I think, right? I mean, you can confirm pull pine trees into their pens a lot of times end of summer. When those bucks are shedding, it's just a there's so many branches on those trees where it can help them shed out, especially if you don't have trees in your pens or you know, areas for them to rub off easier. I mean, I've seen bucks clean up fine without anything like that.
It's amazing.
And then, yeah, exactly. And then it's like it just falls off. They hardly have to do any work.
Sure.
But then you get the bucks that want to go in there and just takes them a little bit, and they just start tearing into a pine tree. And
those autumn olive bushes are just fantastic for, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, because those things, they're hard to kill.
Right.
Like, even at a, like, if you have those in your pens, leave them there, because especially a buck pen. They're awesome. They're super hardy. So back to the nutritional value, you know, dragging in, you know, whatever, hemlock.
Yeah. Lower branches.
So can you make the argument that even though for some inherent reason, they're wired to eat that stuff because they gravitate towards it into winter, right? I think some folks would make the argument that, well, I don't want them eating that because the nutritional value of the feed that I give them is better. So we have this high quality feed, hard feed, grain, and then we have, you know, high quality alfalfa. Those are the only two inputs I wanted to them. I wonder what that counter argument is. Like, is it good to have that? I think diversity generally in diet is excellent regardless, but where is that? Will the animal regulate its own nutritional values in what it takes in? I mean, you're still offering the hard feed, still offering the hay.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that.
I don't either.
I think the only way you could really have a solid argument is to snip the buds off of those trees, send them off to university, and see what kind of what that looks like nutritionally for a deer, you know. I think a happy deer is a healthy deer, and they sure seem to like when you pull that in. The roughage component, I know we have alfalfa, but I have to think they're going to regulate themselves. I mean, we're giving that feed to them. It's still a big portion of their diet, and the way that's performing, I would think that it's... I certainly don't think it's hurting them. But again, to have a good argument on that, we'd have to see, you know, what am I looking for the word, but nutritional values put towards those buds or those branches. I don't know about the bark and all that, but I mean, I've seen them. We have some sassafras trees around my dad's or at the facility down or other facility down east. And they'll destroy the bark on a sassafras before they'll eat it on a oak tree or something like that. Mm. Have you ever smelled sassafras? It smells like
birch beer,
Fruit Loops, or I'd say Fruit Loops. Yeah, birch beer. Exactly right. So there's probably a like candy is to us a just an appeal to it. So in moderation, I don't think it's going to hinder your performance. I certainly don't believe it's hindered my performance on my animals.
Yeah,
I think if anything, especially with young fawns, say, you know, getting into midsummer, I feel, and again, I'm not saying I'm right. I could be very wrong, but just what I view on the farm, when I take browse in like that or leaves on branches and whatnot, I feel like those fawns are eating. It's a good way of getting them to start to mimic their moms and start to pick here and there and start eating feed and all that. Them leaves, I see fawns come up and destroy that with their moms when they're, you know, a month or two old. Is there benefit or is there a cost to that as far as health of the animal? I don't think so at all.
So the summer feeding and winter feeding obviously are two different.
Yeah, sorry, you did say winter feeding.
It's okay. We're coming into February.
Yeah.
Winter is like fully established.
Yeah.
We're coming into the other side, right?
Yeah.
Where spring's closer than winter starting.
Yeah.
And I know that, you know, their diet is, it's just so limited because there's nothing out in the pens except what we give them for the most part.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know people that quote unquote, you know, are establishing breeder facilities with, you know, eight does on 30-acre pastures where they have a variety of polyculture.
Right. Or they can move them in a new 5-acre, you know, pasture. Every
No. So
that'd sure be nice.
But back to the your summer comments on those fawns eating different things. I suspect the microorganisms in each one of those different leaves and tree structures benefits their gut immensely.
Yeah, I think it goes back to diversity. Yeah,
for sure. Oh. You know, you get some maple leaves, you get some oak leaves, grape leaves, branches, you know, different types of forbs and legumes and whatever else. Yeah. I think those are all good. Yeah, it's always, I guess I always find it interesting watching, you know, deer in March, or let's say beginning of April in Pennsylvania, where there's not much green left out there. It's everything's kind of gray and brown, and dormant or dead, and they're still picking at the ground, whatever's there,
right?
You're like, what are you eating? Yeah. You know, like, what is it that you're taking in? Because they're not, it's not like they're hammering the hard feed. You know, if you're getting a pound and a half or 2 pounds a day of hard feed into their systems, I mean, that's it.
No, you're exactly right. It's funny you said that, because last evening before, you know, it's my coming 2-year-old bucks, but I fed them and I backed off and I was at the barns and I'm just watching binoculars, making sure everyone came up and all that, and just kind of doing stuff around the barn. But they come up and eat, but then 10 minutes later, I look halfway out across, it's a 5 or so acre pen they're in, and they're all just like cattle grazing across the pen. And I'm like, what are you, like, to your point, I didn't think of it now, but now you say it. It's like, what were they doing? What are they picking at? What are they doing? You know, and I've mentioned to you, I've been big into reading up on soil health lately.
Yeah, what book are you reading?
I just finished
I love soil or something.
No, like that's the one I'm halfway through. It's For the Love of Soil.
For the Love of Soil, that's right.
Can't remember the girl's name. It's a good book. Basically, not to get off track, but it's transitioning into regenerative agriculture and soil health practices that, you know, get you away from the pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, all the stuff that kills stuff.
Right.
And I'm learning. I'm not saying no, I know it. I'm just learning. And but looking at that and how you manage your pens. Sorry, Josh has yelled at me for tapping on the table. How you manage your pens and your soil health within your breeding pens. I'm questioning this myself. Does it play into the health of your animals? To your point, you know, I've mentioned before that a lot of our pens are the base of it is orchard grass.
Right.
And when a pen goes foul, I'll put some red clover and crimson clover in there. Let it get 6-8 inches tall and put deer in there. But that's very few situations each year. But they're still, especially coming into May, early June, and that orchard grass is just taken off. They're eating it. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily know if that's a good or bad thing, but the fact is they're taking in the plants that are growing in that pen. And there's certainly nutrients there to what and how much.
Orchard grass is really good early.
Early season, yes. Yeah. But then the health of my soil as far as the microbes that you're talking about, the microbiology and all that, that goes into their system.
Yeah.
Hopefully creating a diversity in the microbes in their digestive system and all that's coming out the other end as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important to look at that for the overall health, you know, your herd health program and all that is your pasture management, which we kind of discussed, I think, a little bit on the last time we talked. But I'm certainly digging more into what have I done wrong in the last 10 years? What can I do better going forward in the next 10 years? Because you made a comment on the last podcast, and we joked about this, but we talked about how we, and I'm sure we'll do it again. You say things, you're like, man, I don't even know if I really ever deeply thought about that into my program.
Right.
But there was a trend. Maybe I shouldn't say a trend, but there was a trend a couple of years ago of guys going and spraying is it antimicrobial? Mm-hmm. I don't know what.
Some kind of disinfectant.
Disinfectant on their pens.
Heck, some of them use bleach.
Yeah, so you're going through, and you're not only killing what you think is the bad stuff, you're probably going to be killing a lot of what is good stuff that should be going into your deer system.
It's indiscriminate.
You see fawns when they're first born. I mean, they're picking at the ground. You know, they're picking at dirt. They're starting to nibble on grass, starting to nibble on this or yep. that. The biology of how all that stuff is managed is going to benefit that animal. And I never took that seriously until I'm starting to now.
Right.
One is with herd densities, number one. Mm. But also, how do you manage? Are you soil testing? What are you looking at in that soil test? All that stuff. You know, your organic matter in your soil, how that's helping the microbiology in the soil, which is going to end up in your animals.
Right.
Now, if there's none of that there because you just disinfected it like you're in a freaking, a lab like Penn State where you can't have anything in there, like what you're doing something wrong other than you're doing something wrong if you have to do that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say you're doing something wrong. That can be a management strategy. I don't want to act like what I'm doing is what everyone has to do or we're doing everyone has to do. That's not what I'm saying. It can be a management strategy. It's just not one I want, you know, because overall it's going to trickle down to health of your animals.
Yeah, I continue to look at the white-tailed deer and think about managing them and raising them in the manner that we do and how that presents publicly, how that is similar to other livestock industries and how it's different. And it's a challenge. There's not, you know, everybody, I think as long as you're providing food, water, shelter,
sure.
to these animals, you can raise them in any means that is legal and ethical, right? But I think bigger picture, you know, we have a responsibility as deer farmers and ranchers to look at these deer. We say we love them. We say they're majestic. And yet maybe some of our animal husbandry or rearing efforts don't match what we preach, right? So, oh, we have a majestic animal, the white-tailed deer. Oh, we love our animals. And you see it, and it's in a, you know, 50 by 50 foot pen that's mud. I can't see the majesty or the love. Maybe you do love it, but I don't see the majesty, right? Okay. Now, I'm not saying that you can't necessarily utilize small pens. I'm not saying small pens are bad. But I do think that when we take a deeper look at some of these things, we have to realize that it's not just about what's happening here, that we are a reflection of our industry to others, and that when you look at animal nutrition, housing, pen management, soils, and things like some of these more deeper topics that we talk about, that there is a bigger picture. You know, I think there's a bigger picture. Now, how do we transition or take that kind of larger approach and dial it into these kind of specific things? And I think soil health and soil management is a really interesting place to go with that. Is there soil health or soil management when you have, you know, 20 deer on an acre just beating the crap out of it? I mean, what are you left with to do?
Right.
And I like the discussions we have when we're talking about actually. You know, well, you said you're reading a book on, you know, regenerative soil and things like that. Like, I don't think that's something that's been discussed or promoted or, you know, any of those types of things. Not in the deer industry anyway.
No, and in large parts, it sounds like from what I'm, you know, the you know, YouTube videos, the books I'm reading, the stuff I'm trying to educate myself with, I don't think it's a... I don't think the deer industry is alone in what you just said. I think it's agriculture mm-hmm. in general. And that's not knocking any way of other forms or modern techniques with agriculture. It's just it's a path that I've started to research that I really would like to take my breeding herd into. Because in a sense, I'm already, I don't want to use the word regenerative agriculture for our hunting property, but I'm managing that under what I would consider high standards for quality of food. Let's go back to food, shelter, water. Now, the shelter in a hunting area is more of a timber. It's different. It's not building a shed for the deer to be in. Well, it's the terrain and the management.
Yeah, let me stop you there. So I don't necessarily agree with exactly what you said, because you are managing your property in a regenerative nature. You have a select group of animals that breed out there, and they're creating offspring. You have forestry management, which is regenerating, you know, soils and different types of wood for lumber, etc. You have, you know, different crop fields and things like that. So, like,
sure,
I think it is.
Yeah, in a sense. This was all generally forest to ground when we bought it. Now, there were a handful of pine plantations that were planted from what we understand in the 50s, 60s that were old farms.
Right.
There's some areas, even though we're up in the rolling hills, you can see barbed wire on trees that's grown into it, that mm-hmm. there was obviously fencing here for livestock, I would
Makes
assume.
The loggers happy.
yeah, exactly. I try to flag those when I'm looking at projects. But I'm not necessarily going from degraded agricultural ground and trying to regenerate that. But I am trying to reuse some of these practices I'm learning and how we manage what we're going to start doing now.
Right.
But again, it all to me goes back to the health of your land. And again, I'm just in this bubble right now of soil health. But
yep.
It is something I believe is overlooked, and I think we would all benefit by trying to do better by that. You know, bare soil in general, what I'm specifically talking about here, any bare soil is generally negative in every aspect of soil health, which then turns into plant health, which then turns into animal health. You know, it's all, they're consuming a lot of those plants. But again, the deer, we're not raising a grazing animal as we would if we had cattle and we're doing some sort of grazing management. They're picking, like we said, but I think more so what I have seen in my breeding facility is the, I don't know if it's so much overgrazing. It is a component of that, but just too high of densities that are on the ground, the land on that, in that pen or in that whatever, on that piece of ground for too long. Mm. So then they're beating it down, which you brought up, you know, in our last talk. Number one, it's getting beaten down, and then yes, I guess it's getting chewed down. But it ain't like running cattle. You're not gonna put deer in a lush, you know, you're not gonna take. They're not going to graze it down as quickly as cattle would if you were to put cattle and cycle cattle through there. Mm-hmm. So there is a different, deer are different. You know, in a sense, we say they're browsing species or this and that, but yeah.
No,
lost train of thought. What direction we're heading?
Yeah, no, we're just
chatting.
This we're just freewheeling.
We're trying to figure a name for these BS sessions that we have on deer.
Yeah.
In this podcast,
yeah.
Not BS, but
yeah.
So.
Any
recommendations? It'd be greatly appreciated. I'm sure some of our buddies will send inappropriate.
We need, it has to be PG, PG-13 rated. Whitetails obviously are very different. You had said something when we first started talking about livestock and then regeneration, and I lost exactly what I wanted to comment on. But deer are very different than pretty much every other livestock species in that they have value on top or above their food value. And that's really an interesting component, you know.
Yeah, specifically white-tailed deer. Yeah.
Yeah, when you add trophy, it changes the dynamic of what you can do. So, you know, when you look at, we were talking about the problems with other or all livestock industry and soil, I think. Do you think it's because people have to raise, that they're only raising cows, pigs, chickens, et cetera, for food, and that there's not this other kind of value add that the deer has that changes the economics of it and doesn't allow them to do things, you know? So like, and I'm...
Clarify that a little bit, like, okay, an example.
So like, let's look at, okay.
I was with you, but I just...
Yeah. A chicken, right? Yeah. How are 95% of the chickens raised in the United States?
Unfortunately, inside. In-house, yeah.
Inside.
Yeah, confinement. Okay.
So you have...
Even the organic ones and right. What do they call it? Yeah, yeah. Let's just stay off of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're raised inside. Yeah.
We'll leave it to the government to come up with a term.
Or industry.
Yeah, big industry. Yeah. Well, why does industry do that, though? Because of some government regulation. Anyway, let's not.
Yes, exactly. Yes. You're exactly. Okay, you're so, right. You're right. They're so, forced to come up with titles.
Yeah.
Yep.
So
definitions.
The, you know, cows, right? Generally speaking, and I'm just throwing numbers out. This doesn't mean anything. So you take a you know, 1,000-pound cow to the market, and you get $3,000 for it, right? Okay. If that cow had hunt value, it would change how you could raise it. Now, some people pasture raise cows. Some people, and when I say pasture, I mean like big honking chunks of ground where they have, you know, 100, sure. 100 cows on like, you know, 1,000 acres. And some of those don't see the feedlot, right? And then there's others that raise them in more feedlot style conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you come to whitetails and what we would consider traditional or natural to their environment, why do you think that we as an industry have not adapted more of the natural principles to...
Yeah, I would argue we've almost raised them.
Husbandry side.
Yeah, I would argue we've almost raised them like feedlot animals from the beginning. Is that the point you're kind of getting?
It is. It is. And to say,
not all. Again,
Some do and some don't. But generally, like, we've taken them and we've probably overcrowded them, even to the point.
We've definitely overcrowded them.
Yeah. So what
me,
is
it? I'm guilty of it. You've been guilty of it. This isn't a knock on anyone. This is,
for sure.
Yeah.
So what is it that we can do? Can we take things from what we already know? What are those things? And start reintroducing them into our kind of our management strategies or soil health strategies. What does that look like? What is actually functional?
I'm going to get in trouble here. I was thinking about this the other day. And there's value to what people have been, and we've said it. I know you and I have also promoted it, but as a deer industry, we've promoted, again, I don't know if this is good or bad. I'm just going to say it just because we're having a conversation. We've promoted that, hey, you can take marginal land or you can take this hillside that you have and you can raise deer on it and you can make money. True. That's not, there's truth to that. But again, we've never, not that everyone has done that, but we've promoted we can raise these deer on marginal land. So all of a sudden, everybody who has a little bit, little half acre here, a little acre there, little 5 acres back here, I keep banging the table. they can raise deer now. And yes, some have been very successful in taking a marginal piece of land and making it, more valuable than it was just sitting there doing nothing with it. But at the same time, you've seen hillside, let's use a hillside example, a rocky hillside, somebody puts a deer pen in, and 3 to 5 years later, it is, the roots are exposed from the trees are dying. Every storm they get is just water. You can't grow any ground cover up there in many cases, because density also plays into that. Mm-hmm. But, I think maybe some people have been sold the idea that you can raise deer anywhere. And I'm sure there's strategies to raise deer anywhere, but they're not all the same. You can't equate yourself to the guy who has 30 acres of rolling pasture with a couple patches of woods here and there for shade, for shelter, for that, but also, has the space. You can't compare yourself to doing the same management strategies that you may need to do if you fence a wooded hillside off. The biggest challenge is being able to afford land. So I'm going to say that first, but space, going back to our conversation, I think lower densities, bigger area is kind of what you and I have been preaching here in the last couple discussions, but just those two things raise a healthier animal. Just those two things. What those are for your farm, I don't know. I'm not going to answer that for anybody. But having good management strategies with your pastures, with your herd densities, it all plays into it.
So
I've obviously lost my train of thought there.
No, that's fine.
Not my train of thought. I guess I made my point that you can't – don't just think because you have – some extra land that you're going to go be successful at raising deer. That was the point.
The assessment of land for the raising of deer is not something that comes into the conversation.
There you go. That's why you're here, to take all my crazy thoughts into one sentence.
I think you're exactly right. So I haven't had the need to, but I think it's a valid point. Someone that has, a side hill or a side mountain, right, that's wooded and potentially rocky because it's a mountain, and they have 30 acres is very, very different in their ability to be able to have a commercial breeding operation for white-tailed deer than the person in the valley that's got 30 acres of farm ground. It's very different. So it's not that you're right in when you say that we've sold this idea that deer can be raised anywhere, and they can, and you touched on that. It's just how many and what type of operation, right? And how is that structured? Because you probably can raise some really nice deer on the side of a mountain. You're just not going to raise near the same number as the guy down in the valley, because the ground's just not going to allow you to do it.
No, and you're going to have costs associated with
that.
Oh,
my gosh. So it's unreal. Unreal cost.
The guy, let's just like the nice scenario, rolling hills. He has nice runoff. He has enough ground cover where he's not losing his soil. His trees aren't becoming uprooted and the roots and all that are coming out. I've seen this happen in my own pens where your divider fence between pens, especially on a slope, gets beat up because deer like to just walk that fence line, especially when you introduce new deer. So you have costs associated with that. You got washouts. You got to fix those every. You got trees falling down, potentially falling down on an interior fence. Hopefully it's an interior fence. So you got to fix that fence. All these poor land management decisions are going to cost you down the road, mm-hmm. which in turn you're going to be less profitable than the guy who, equal amount of ground to your point, can run maybe, 2 or 3 head more per acre. Because his ground will allow it. Just I guess the point is, know what your ground will allow. And some of that, unfortunately, comes with experience, because nobody's out there teaching us exactly what that is.
Yeah.
And we don't know either. We're just, you've got to, I think, start slow and progress and see where it can take you.
No, I like that. And I know that, early 2000s, kind of right in the beginning stages of the boom of the deer industry, people were putting up fence wherever they could. Mm-hmm. And that idea of you can raise deer anywhere was the only argument. And I think over time, you know, people have figured out, maybe they have, maybe they haven't. I think I figured it out, and based on the conversation that we're having, you have as well, that there are limitations to what that looks like, and that you really need to be judicious about how you evaluate your land and your operation.
From an economic standpoint, you could get away with poor management 10 years ago because of the cost because of what you could get for an animal in the breeding world.
That's interesting.
I've purchased some animals that hindsight I regret, because when I went to the facility, you know, maybe there was poor management, and then turn the animal was in poor condition, whether I realized it at the time of purchase or not, which, you know, led down a path of which, you know, either antibiotics or animal dying or whatever that is. But when you could put a pedigree in a catalog, take it to a sale, and you know, average, who knows, way higher than we are today.
10 or 15,
say it's 10 or 15 grand for a fawn.
Yep.
You can. I hate to say it this way, but you could afford to make a lot of mistakes and still make money. That was worth you. That was enough money that you would be willing to continue to do what you're doing. When that all fell out from underneath itself, the realization is, okay, we need to be better managers. It all comes down to just being better managers, you know, whether it's with your money, your animals, your feed, your time, all that, to make a operation profitable, worthwhile doing it.
I think that's a really valid way to look at it. And as soon as the economics have shifted, we've shifted back to the place that we should have started from, and that's fundamentals.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember.
Yeah, right.
Yep,
I didn't
right?
start with fundamentals.
Yep.
I thought I did back then. Who knows?
Yeah.
We were both in our young 20s,
yep.
You know?
I was a little older than that, but yeah, sure. No.
Yeah.
So the idea back then had nothing to do with the fact if you could or couldn't raise deer, you could or couldn't put up a fence, you could or couldn't have a handling facility. Those things were all pretty easy, right? It should have been all about taking care of the deer in animal husbandry, but we were just buying pieces of paper.
In many instances.
I mean,
you know, another,
the overwhelming majority of our dollars spent were on paper.
And from the first year you have your farm, things might seem great. Year one, year two, year three. I'm banging on the table again. I'm going to put handcuffs on me. The year one, year two, year three, you might be like, this is great. Fawns are healthy. Deer are healthy. Bucks are healthy. But then going back to density, you start, you know, long story short is, what I've seen in my own operation is your numbers started growing and you weren't ready for it. You weren't prepared for it, especially when the breeding market dropped, you know, faded for many people. Now you have these excess females. You used to be able to sell five or six of those or eight, whatever those numbers were for your farm. Now you're like, oh, I gotta figure out something to do with them, which can take us to a next point when I go there is producers. I'm going to use Pennsylvania as the example. It's what I'm most familiar with. But I would argue that producers today, the value is in your bucks as a deer farm. Doesn't mean you shouldn't continue to breed for females to improve your herd, but those excess females that you have need to go somewhere. Which is the challenge of today, because taking them to an auction and you know, especially giving someone else the benefit of your hard work for a couple hundred dollars is not worth it to me. As far as a genetic component to add to other people's herd. I don't mean that as, you know, to sound like anything, but it comes to the point of what is the other outlet for those females? Finding yourself a slaughter market or that's about it,
mm-hmm.
You know? And we've had that challenge, you and I, trying to discuss that with our regulatory bodies of how we can more easily and efficiently do that for producers as far as a market for meat for those animals. But when we lost the ability to easily move females off for good money, things started to change, and they had to change. And I think that's where we're at. That's where a lot of people are at today, and especially if new producers are listening, like your herd's going to grow, and what is your plan? Have a plan now for next year, the year after that, 3 years down the road. Have a plan now what to do with the, I'm going to say females, because that's the reality of the situation. Maybe you can sell some good females to a hunting property that's managing their genetics, that wants to introduce, you know, new genetics into that property. That's an outlet. I think it needs to grow as an outlet here in the Northeast. But also it may mean taking some to slaughter, you know?
I think that's an interesting point, is the female value. And when you look at females, you know, they produce the product that is ultimately responsible as your main revenue driver. So you can't discount them from the equation, but you can only keep so many. And then you have to start making some really hard decisions, you know, especially if you have time-wise, a pretty well-established farm. When you start getting, you know, beyond, you know, 5, 10, depending on the growth rate of your farm, 5, 10, 15 years, and you're not putting those females into other farms for breeding, you know, it's hard picking out the ones you don't want anymore.
Yes.
You know, like, so I've been actively calling does on my farm and, you know, feeding my family and the people around me with some super high quality venison. And for those that have not had the opportunity to eat farm-raised venison, or at least the venison that we raise at my place, is absolutely phenomenal. Like, it is good stuff. And I'm, you know, for me, I'm surrounded by mountains. So, like, you go take a deer on the mountain, it tastes like shit. You know, it's been eating freaking...
It's so harsh.
No, it's not.
You just gotta learn how to cook.
Okay.
I'm just kidding. Josh cooks good, so I like to dig him.
All I know is that...
Yeah, raise a cow on corn or raise a cow on grass-fed. What do you like better?
There's a very vegetal, I think, a very vegetal taste to mountain deer.
A what taste?
Vegetal.
Explain the definition. I don't know what
that is. So, like vegetable?
Yeah.
Like green? I think gaminess, in some cases, is confused with what the animal's eating. And I'm talking about...
Take the silver skin off. They didn't take the tendons out. That plays into gaminess, too.
It can. I'm talking about...
I'm not trying to hate on your farm animals. No, how good they taste. I'm just...
Listen.
They taste good because you know the value they actually have, and you can't get it right now. They taste even... They should taste worse in that case.
I've eaten $10,000 tenderloin before, so... Yeah. Nothing like having a... Hang on. So I had this buck from a incredibly expensive doe, and I found him hooked in wire, and I saw him the night before when I fed at like whatever 8 o'clock.
Not hooked in the fence,
and he was fine. And I came in the next day, and like I knew he had just died, so I took the back straps out of him, ate him, and it was a very expensive deer.
Right.
Anyway, my point is that farm-raised venison is, in my eyes, really good. So vegetal, back to vegetal.
Is that even a word?
Yeah.
Okay.
Google it.
I don't have my phone.
All right. If you're listening, somebody send Jared an email about vegetal.
You want to spell that? No, kidding. Go ahead.
I can't spell. I mean, V-G-A-T-A-L or something. Vegetal.
Certainly. There's a higher quality in a sense, like I was saying, of a grain-fed piece of steak or a grass-fed piece of steak. There's a difference.
You can taste it.
I think there's people that like each one for different reasons. But yes, I would agree that the corn-fed beef is going to taste much better.
Especially in the fat. You can really taste it in the fat.
Same with the deer.
Well, fat is flavor, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Same with the deer.
Yeah, deer. Not that they have a lot of fat, and not that you're eating deer fat, but I think there's a certain quality to farm-raised venison.
And the challenge to that is if you want to look at white-tailed deer as a potential food product, I think there's a necessity for that. I am fortunate to be able to I breed my animals and have does that I'm putting into a large hunting area because I want them to replicate those genetics in a more of a natural breeding situation. That's a benefit that I personally have, or others with hunting areas, hunting preserves have, if they're managing that way. The challenge we found is you run up against a brick wall with some of our our bureaucrats, we'll call them, in our government, in our Department of Agriculture. You know, we can do custom slaughter. I don't know if you want to get into this, but we can do a custom slaughter, which is someone buys the whole, I'm generally speaking, so look it up if you're actually going to do it, but you can sell an animal off the farm. It has to be killed at your farm. It can be bought as a whole by an individual and taken and being butchered for individual consumption, personal consumption, whatever that language looks like. But for us to take white-tailed deer and get them commercially slaughtered, we've run into brick walls with that. You trying to find ways to get that better approved. So you know, we can have the same way you can take a red deer, even elk, I believe, in our state, you can get them commercially slaughtered, and you can get them slaughtered for commercial sale. We can't do that with the whitetail right now. And, you know, we've heard all the bullshit the BS from some of our regulators, what do you want to call them?
Yeah.
And I think it's a little bit of nonsense that they're going against us having a legitimate marketplace for venison through white-tailed deer. But, you know, there's challenges to them through other political issues. But it shouldn't be as hard for us to get that done. And I think it needs to be done. I think there needs to be a meat market for whitetails, whether that's jerky, whether that's pet food, whether that he brought up pet food before. But aside from that, you know, that's a industry responsibility to try and get those markets opened. But the other thing is farmers need to realize the need to remove, we're using the females because it mostly is the females, off of your farm for a price that's not breeder sale price. It's covering your costs, maybe making a little bit of money to just get them animals off your farm. It's saving you money, obviously, in the long run by less animals.
But covering costs is interesting because, I mean, my deer eats
$400
a year.
It's saving you from those high densities, which are going to cost you in the future.
That's true.
If you keep them. That's, I guess, what I meant to say. You're not making money on the individual by any means, even if we get the markets opened up. You know, I sent, before we started hunting preserve and I was able to start introducing bred females into that property, and I sent 22 animals to slaughter in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. You know, I got a couple $1,000 check out of that, but through all the hassle, the permitting and all that, it's just a way of removing animals that need to be removed off your farm for the health of the farm in the future. You know, not in a way to make a living. By no means am I saying the meat market's going to, in white-tailed deer, is going to make anyone a living.
Yeah,
any farmer a living.
Yeah, the white-tailed carcass is not, at least today, is not a viable, you know, meat.
Way to make a livelihood.
Yeah, meat carcass. I wonder, you know, I've been trying to push my deer to get bigger, right, at younger ages. You know, I got 180, at least this year, I got 180 pound year and a half old doe. Now, again, I'm feeding expensive feed, so what does that look like on a lesser feed? You know, not developed for
high performance.
My particular operation. I'm curious, you know, because like you could take fallow deer. I've never raised a fallow deer in my life, so I'm simply speculating. But you could take a fallow deer, put it out on pasture, give it some corn, and the thing grows well. And you have like almost nothing into it as far as cost.
Relative to what we do with the white
tails. Yeah, that's exactly right. So I wonder, you know, is it just because of our feed costs? You know, and then we get back into this place where like you're trying to pack as many animals onto a specific piece of ground, you know, to maximize your dollar and feed costs into, you know, raising an animal that really shouldn't be raised there. Because you're trying to do this meat market thing.
Right.
That's
So the going back to the deer farmer, the deer breeder. Again, I'm talking mostly Northeast, but I think this is going to be general across the nation here, in, you know, in short time. But so what do you do as a farmer then? So we have sex semen out there. So a farmer can take male sex semen. This sounds simple. It's not as simple as it sounds. Breed females, get more males. You know, if you were having, say, 50-50 on average, you're going to try and take that to 70-30. How do you look at the use? We have our thoughts. I'm just getting us into this conversation now. Because as the farmer who's out there trying to be as profitable as he can be, there probably is a management strategy that you can implement sex semen to make, you know, I keep saying more profitable, make your farm more successful financially. I think there's pros and cons, but I'm just curious to get into that conversation.
Yeah.
We went from soil health to sex semen, but that's what we do in these conversations.
That's good. I think that sex semen generally can be used as a exceptional tool on your farm. I actually think that just a couple years ago, I thought that was the only way.
I remember these conversations.
Yeah. I'm starting to
think. I think you told me it has to work. We were brainstorming. You're like, it has to work.
Yeah.
In a sense, what you're saying, that once we get through thinking about this, it's got to be the right way to go.
Yeah, so I came to the point at that time, and I don't know how long ago it was, but it was multiple years ago, 3, 4, 5, that sex semen at that point was the only tool that we had to make a profitable entity out of a deer farm with where the market was. Now, I don't think the market's changed. Do you?
No.
I think if anything, I think the market has stabilized. We've come into a place where you have to dial in your fundamentals. We mentioned that before. Fundamentals are key. I actually think that I'm not mentioning fundamentals again. I think that's a good name for our segment is fundamentals. But I actually believe that there is more opportunity in developing a niche market for your farm as opposed to becoming a buck factory or whatever you want to call it. So this idea has to be achieved through what I call function stacking. And if you want to hear my thoughts further on function stacking and what that is, I did a podcast called The Function Stack before.
You discussed antler sales, potential sales.
Yeah, we talk about
other enterprises through your deer farm.
Revenue models.
Streams. Yeah.
Yep, exactly. But the niche farm or niche market is for the farmer to separate himself from other farms. And what does that look like for me? What that looks like for me is developing female lines and female line genetics, which in turn are going to give me bucks, but I'm just talking about girls right now, that are uniquely bred, potential outcrosses for other farms with like-minded thinking towards genetics that I have, that will then patronize me by buying semen from bucks that I produce. So this is a long, this is a long-term play. I'm actually more interested in female semen today than I am male semen. And I don't have any more room to grow. So I need bucks. But the basis of my breedings is almost exclusive to making more girls today. Now, I'm not, there's a percentage of my offspring that are going to be bucks, regardless of what I do. I could breed every deer on my farm to female semen. I'm going to get some bucks, right? And by the way, the conception rate on female semen is better than male from what I understand. Okay, so. And then, so this is gonna mind warp some people, but like.
You do that to me all the time.
So we just said that we need to kill these does, and I'm telling you to make more does. Okay, so this is counterintuitive. I promise that if farms focus in a really kind of determined way to make better females, ultimately I think those farms will be better off in the long run. Now, what does that mean? Because everybody's like, oh, I'm going to breed with this great buck. And I mean, I don't think that there is under 10% of all the bucks in the whitetail industry that I would even consider breeding with. So in my eyes, 90% of the deer out there are garbage.
The next producer, I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
The next producer, you know, I could say the same thing.
Yes.
But the 10% of the bucks that I'm looking at, not one of them is the same 10% that you're looking at.
And that's fine.
In our situation, that's probably not true, but that is true for other breeders. Yes. So 90% are garbage in your mind. It's 90% are garbage in Jared's mind, but they're not the same deer.
Yes.
So there is room for variety.
Tons. And and I'm not.
You're not knocking that. I'm just saying. Like,
yeah. So when I just called the overwhelming majority of the deer industry's bucks garbage, they're only garbage to me.
Exactly.
They're not garbage generally. And
so don't get all sensitive.
I'm not
in this world.
Don't get all sensitive. That's exactly right. Simply what I'm saying by saying they're garbage is that I would not incorporate them or their genetics, partially their genetics maybe, into my herd. I just have such a narrow vision of what I want to do that it, by sheer numbers, it limits my interactions with the deer that I can pick from. It's just such a small group. I mean, it's like a handful of animals. Now, is this right or wrong? I don't know. It appears to be, in my eyes, what I'm seeing over time, it appears to be right. But the jury's out on that. I'm in the infant stages of building.
You mean of what you in your mind have for what that deer is, the direction you're heading, you see that as a long-term, let's say, fail-proof deer that you're trying to create.
Yeah.
That will always be part of the market, no matter how the market fluctuates.
Yeah, there's...
And I'll speak for Josh, that's a big, gorgeous, classic whitetail.
Yeah.
Generally a typical deer.
I think that the most recognizable animal has the most value. So if we put two pictures side by side, right? We put...
Can I cut into some of your before you, I know where you're heading, and I don't mean. So, I would argue that that is great what you're doing, and I've said this to you before, and I'm not sure if my definitions are right. So, if we got like some really good cattle producers or other livestock producers out there that hear me say this and I'm wrong, just let me know. But I see you as being what would be considered to my knowledge, as a seed stock producer.
Yep.
Where you are you are wanting to produce stock that in other agriculture or other livestock industries that would be sold either to other seed stock producers or also to commercial producers, and those commercial producers are not going to use those animals the same way that you are using them. They're going to use them to produce a product for a different marketplace, right? Our, you know, mm-hmm. more than likely it's going to be the actual cows we eat, if we were talking about cows.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to be eating your cows, quote unquote, that your deer, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's one path you certainly can take, which is what you're explaining. I just want to be clear to people listening that that's a pathway you can choose, but you can also choose to be that commercial, what I would call a commercial stocker producer in the deer world, where you can take the benefits. Now you're going to pay for the semen, which is your goal to sell semen, or the animal. You can take those animals, work them into your program to produce those bucks that you're then going to be selling. That is the main stream of income for your farm. Because, and to go along with that, for your plan to work, and this is a challenge we're facing in Pennsylvania right now, in the area we are currently sitting in, a lot of guys can't sell animals. Not that they can't because there's no market for them. They've been told by our government that we can't move animals out of this certain area because of disease management protocols that they have put
yep.
in. So that changes the game where you got to decide, can you be one of these producers that can produce breeding stocks? Because I do think there's a market for stock to be sold for guys to use for breeding. I still think it's there. It's not near as big as it used to be. But then the quote-unquote what I'm calling the commercial producers, especially though, or sorry, though if you want to be that, you can't be that in certain areas of our state anymore.
So
unless you want to sell to two counties or three counties.
So I was just about to say, what I am trying to do is, again, counterintuitive to what I'm actually, what I actually do. So I said that I want to make does, right? I haven't sold the doe off my farm in 6 years.
Right.
I'm trying to make more does. The only way they're leaving is dead right now. But I believe that if I can create a female line that is in line with the vision that I have, that I will be in a position in the hopefully near future, when there are opportunities to do commerce safely without regulatory capture, that I'm able to do that. And I'm in a position to sell to the people that I think will want those animals. Back to the picture.
I just write down regulatory capture. That was fantastic.
Regulatory capture. Yeah. Regulatory capture is AKA the government putting you out of business for disease management reasons. So back to the picture that I was...
Yeah, I'm sorry. I just wanted to...
It's all good. Yeah, no, I appreciate that. So when you take and you put a picture of a 220 10 point and a 500 inch 60 point and you put them next to each other in velvet and then you turn them and you show them to 100 different people. 10 are deer farmers, 90 of them are hunters. Most of the hunters aren't even going to recognize what species that the 500 inch 60 point animal is. They're going to ask you, what is that? They're not even going to know it's a whitetail. Now, am I saying that we shouldn't strive to raise 500-inch animals? No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that it can be done in a tasteful way. We can get these animals big, 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 and they can still look like deer. But I haven't seen many of those, if any. Not in that 500-inch range. Very, very few, right? So for me...
Which is still a hard deer to raise.
Incredible. Yeah.
So it's exactly... Both.
I think the 220 10 point and the 500-inch 60 pointer today are very similar in class in their challenge to raise.
Yes.
I would say that the 500-inch 60 pointer is easier with today's genetics that are readily available than the 2-20-10 point.
Agreed.
Okay. So, number one, I like a challenge because I'm a hard-headed, red-blooded American. And I wouldn't do it if it wasn't hard. Now, what is the purpose of raising the 2-20-10 point? Market share. If I have something that someone can look at and that everybody agrees is beautiful, right? But there's recognition in what it is, I will develop a market that more people want. So does that mean that I need to, what's the best way to say this? Does that mean that I need to alienate myself from a large portion of the deer industry through my genetic selection choices? Yes, it absolutely does. It means that I need to hold myself to a higher standard. That probably...
I would call it a specific standard.
And that's fine. Well, so I'm going to...
In your mind, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. No, and you're right. It is a specific standard. But I believe that that specific standard is a higher standard. And why do I believe that? Because people can actually recognize what the 2-20-10 point is. That's true. When someone has to ask you what species that is, and you have to tell them, that's the same thing as on the other side of the fence, that's a problem. Yeah. This is just what I believe. I'm not saying this is right or wrong.
No. I'm in many ways in line with that. I love this. This is good. This is getting into one of our good conversations.
Here. I didn't tell you that I'm trying to raise a 500-inch deer, did I? That's true.
There's certainly value put on these animals. And when, you know, speaking to the larger scoring, highest scoring animals in the marketplace each year, there can be an extreme amount of value attached to that animal that people
profitable.
Will pay.
No doubt.
And it makes it understandable why guys would take their herds in a big way, say a large percentage of their breeding strategies, to try and produce those animals. There are also consequences, I believe, to a full-scale 100% or a large portion of your females being bred in that direction, because you end up with a whole lot. And I'm not just picking on anybody. I mean, we've seen it in our marketplace where you end up with a whole bunch of animals that, regardless of their scores, let's just say they're all 300-inch plus.
They're big.
And guys are like, well, you know, a 300-inch deer can be harvested at a preserve for so-and-so price, so I should get 50 of that. Well, no, it needs to be harvestable. Hmm. Someone needs to want to, you know, I'm going into the hunting side of things, which is not cut and dry as I'm making it. It's not near as cut and dry as how I'm making it right now. But if there's not a hunter for the deer, it ain't worth a dime, no matter what it scores. So we've seen these deer who are what I know I've called byproducts of trying to breed these giant 500- and 600-inch deer, and these byproducts are 300- and 400-inch animals selling for $1,100 a piece. I watch it at auctions. I mean, you watch guys get up and walk away who are the bidders; they're not interested. So,
why aren't they interested?
Is it because they can't get? They don't have the clientele willing to purchase that animal.
Right.
So the question is, do you risk a large portion of your farm? I don't know what those numbers are, to try and get one or two. And there's been some guys in our industry who have done a good job at raising these, let's call them mega giants, and been successful at it. But the guys I'm thinking of right now also have a component of good-looking, pretty deer. I'm not saying they're clean typicals. I'm just saying deer under 300 inches that are good-looking deer that can be harvested. And with those couple mega giants, they can compensate for those couple byproducts that I'm talking about. But if you take your whole herd in that direction, you're going to have so much byproduct that is unsellable that I don't care if you raise a 500 or 600 once every 3 years because it ain't going to pay your bills.
No.
It'll be 1 year, you'll be like, oh, yeah, I sold this deer for blah, 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 whatever.
It's going to cost you money.
And, yeah, so there is high risk to that high reward. I don't know everyone's financials, but I do believe that, you know, I've always come at my breeding program as not as specific as you. I guess I consider myself a little more of a what I consider commercial breeder, where big and pretty. Raise them as pretty as I can, as big as I can, and that means a couple different things throughout my herd. And there's a couple different visions I have with segments of my herd. But I started raising deer because I wanted to put genetics into a hunting property where then I would have be able to bring hunters into a private estate and be able to hunt big, gorgeous deer. And so I've always stuck to that. There's a vision in my mind. It kind of, you know, sways back and forth. But if you can't, and you want to maximize on, you know, if you're asking a guy to pay you a certain amount of money to come hunt your property, you better have some good looking deer in there for him you better have some deer in there that they're going to pull the trigger on, you know, or genetics in there to produce those deer. Because if you don't, well, you're not going to be successful. So, I agree with you that we have sometimes created a product that is unrecognizable and has been detrimental to our industry. It's been, and I hate saying that, my own devil's advocate or my own, not devil's advocate, I'm my own hypocrite, but I don't knock the guy who sold a really high scoring deer for great price and shit, he paid all his bills in one deer.
Nor do I.
Many cases. I know you don't. I'm not saying you do. Nope. I'm not saying you do. I didn't mean it that way. But at the same time, it's hard to, I believe it's hard to, calculating our success as an industry on, I don't think we can grow.
Well, that, and
and that's, you know, there's markets for those deer, but I think it's been a challenge to allow for the private deer management, which all goes to hunting. The deer started going behind a fence to create better hunting properties, period. Not pets, not meat, period. It's the hunting world. And we've had a challenge being accepted as a whole. We'll never be accepted by some. And those, I could care less. But as an industry, if we're talking industry as a whole, there is a certain acceptance there that we need before government shuts us down. And that's any agriculture industry. That's the confinement barns, however you're talking about. But and it goes to your point that those animals are accepted. They're understood. And you can sell that reality a lot better.
And
we started this conversation with sex semen.
Thanks. So when I talk about perception of our industry and like in the case that we're talking about, recognizing an mm-hmm. animal mm-hmm. for a species, it's because I've put myself in a position where I have to advocate for the industry in front of people that make rules and regulations about our industry. And when you go to someone who doesn't, they know what a deer is, they understand what livestock is and what it does and kind of some of the components of agriculture, and then you have to explain to them that these animals potentially need their antlers cut in July because they're too big, or that we're trying to, propagate, a certain type of animal for a certain thing. That's the bridge that is hard to make. when we stick with inside the norms that is traditional, the overwhelming majority of people understand that. So in, I think in all of our discussion today, you can look at the various things that we've talked about and say, how can we, as close to possible, mimic the whitetail in its traditional sense, whether that be in the rearing, how do we equate our pasture environments to a wild environment, in a food consumption way, how do we make the carcass and the quality of the meat enhanced or even better than what it was outside the fence. From a perception or public facing standpoint, how do we show that that we are creating and that we do fit into this more traditional style livestock arena, but we've developed it for a different species, the white-tailed deer. And when you start tying all those together, you come to the place where I'm yelling into the microphone about deer I don't like in the industry. It's not that. And let me clarify, everybody has the right and the opportunity to raise whatever they like. And I am trying to raise a 500-inch animal.
Sure.
I am trying to do that, but I'm trying to do it in a calculated way.
I will. I'm not trying to argue.
Go ahead. Please do.
We got time, or you?
We do. Just don't hit the table.
I like a lot of what you just said, but here's where I again, maybe we are our own hypocrites, because, in a sense of. I use myself and my family as an example of what are trying to accomplish with our properties and our animals. I certainly am not interested in being traditional with my deer in a sense where I am managing for 130-inch bucks. Because that's, you know, you're getting towards the top end of what you can produce with the native deer herds around this area. You know, you get 150, 160 inch deer here and there, but you know, you're going to be somewhere in that 100 to 125 inch on your average 4-year old buck. So I don't want to be traditional in that sense.
Sure.
We're obviously investing this as a private business to be profitable, to make a living, to pay for our properties and be something different. I say better, better land, better genetics, bigger deer, better hunting experience, higher quality hunting experience. You know, fence does not dictate a hunting experience. That's a whole nother discussion, but it can and it can't. But we're creating a high quality experience with high quality animals, and it's a hunting club. You know, it's a private hunting club, but private animals. So that's the only pushback I'm going to give you on the traditional mindset of, you know, you go to a legislator, yeah, my deer are bigger, and they better be, or else I ain't making a dime.
So let me.
That's the only. I mean,
no,
I'm nitpicking at your
please do
comments, but
I think that's that's a good point. Go ahead.
But I just to finish my thought, you know, I you know, someone could easily challenge me and be like, well, how big's too big? And you know, I can have my own opinions on that, and that's. I'm allowed to, and you're allowed to have your own opinions, and other people are allowed to have their own opinions. Some might say, as big as I can get them. And okay, good. Doesn't mean you're going to work with I'm going to work with you in the genetic production of my animals for my hunting properties, but feel free to do it. There's a marketplace for it. I just don't think that's a way to make a consistent business year in and year out on raising whitetail bucks, if you're listening to this as a deer farmer trying to produce a product to sell to some of the hunting preserves or facilities around the state. That's all.
No, I agree with that. And I think that
by making your whole herd that way is what I meant.
Oh,
you know, by going in that, say, 400 and beyond.
I think we all started there. I think we all tried to kind of do that. And I think some of us have abandoned that for a reason, because it's it's way too much work. It's so hard.
Yeah.
And it's not that we're scared of the work. It's because there's other
Well, I think guys have tried to take all their animals and make those right. five, all their females and tried to make them 500-inch producers. And you realize, no, if you have a niche group of females that you've seen do it, and it's an animal that you can grow out to finish, and it's that these sizes we're talking about, then keep that female line and work specifically with that, and take these other females and do what's right for them.
Put them in the freezer.
Well, no. No, maybe that's
sure.
good-looking 180 to 200-inch deer, which you can consistently sell every year, year in and year out.
Yep.
And that's your moneymakers there. And this other group of 5, 6, 8 does that can maybe pump out 1, 300, 400-plus or 2 or 3 each year, that's icing on your cake. Does that make sense? Like,
it does.
Find what builds... this sounds terrible. Find what builds your cake, and then you can work with, you know, doing some things to put an icing on it.
I could eat some cake right now. I haven't really had lunch.
Going back to soil health, they sure also look like chocolate cake.
So I got some Junior Mints here that I've been working on. Yeah. Oh, chocolate cake, yeah. You got something for me?
Well, you ready to finish up? How long do we got?
I can talk for as long as you like.
So, I just want to go back because I having these conversations, I'm not saying we're being helpful to anybody, but it'd be nice if someone can take something that, you know, you explained your...
We're helpful to you and I.
Exactly. And hopefully we help you others a little bit. You know, I'm going to go back to you being a seed stock producer.
Okay.
And I'm going to go back to sex semen. Go all the way back to where the use of it. You obviously, with your program at the moment, and how you foresee it, male. I said sex semen, and you did. You did actually. You stayed on track with sex semen because you said you're more interested in female sex semen
today.
I would argue with you that the majority of our producers today are looking at male sex semen to the points we stated before. There's a much better market for male, a male-finished product, if you want to call it that, male bucks, to be sold than there is for a female-finished product for a large portion of our producers. And I say ours, Pennsylvania, but I'm sure this can relate to a lot of other
ours,
states.
All our fellow deer farmers.
Fellow deer farmers, okay. It's your podcast. You make that clear. When you look at that, and a guy has, let's just use 20 females. He has a consistent breeding herd of 20 females that he's breeding every fall.
Yep.
Or he's fawning out every spring, 20 females. If he can, those 20 females, let's just use easy numbers, they're giving you...
2 fawns each.
40 fawns.
Yep.
20 are bucks, 20 are does.
Yep.
So he has these 20 does that... doe fawns that either could be replacements, and if they're not replacements, they need to go somewhere.
Yep.
And the replacements that they're replacing, or the does they're replacing, have to go somewhere as well. So there's always a need to remove those females. Well, if he has the space and the availability, the argument could be that sex semen could take him to a point where maybe he only wants to replace, 10 females a year. So he wants to try and increase his percentage to 30 bucks a year, 10 females a year. Again, these are easy numbers. These aren't including losses, all that. Easy numbers. So I know there's other products, but that are being marketed today that can sway you one way or the other on males to female ratios. But to sex semen, male sex semen can be used to try and get you to that higher percentage of males than it is females.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's kind of a, would you argue that's true. That can be true.
100%. Yes.
So, not getting into success rates on your AI, what all that looks like, that's to your own farm, but there is a use for it. And how do you think guys should utilize that? Or maybe I'll state how I would argue.
Let me go first.
Okay, you go first.
So
how would they utilize male semen to increase the percentage of males that can be sold to the marketplace each year?
Use sex semen.
Yeah.
Use male sex semen.
Yep, exactly.
You answered the question. But you know, even if your percentage conception rate is not great, you're still adding males and reducing females that are born. Sex, semen, and, you know, upping percentages. And I was talking about the, you know, going from, you had mentioned 30, you know, 30 from the 20-20 split on your fawns to 30 buck fawns, 10 doe fawns from a selfish perspective, because I want to think about my business in a way that I can, benefit the most from the marketplace. I would encourage as many people as I can to use male sex semen, because, and I'll tell you why. So for me, again, I'll use a term, advance the breed. When I am breeding, I am specifically trying to incorporate genetics that I think will enhance my animal's ability to come closer to my goal. And you can make all the bucks you want, but they don't take you generationally towards that goal, in my opinion. So I am going to continue to advance my doe program, you know, generation after generation after generation. And I need, with my small herd, I need those numbers to benefit me, right? And when I say that, those numbers, I mean the percentage of females that I get versus the percentage of males. Now, I'm not actively weighting my herd with female semen. I have such a small herd that I only have a couple does I need to put female semen in. That's like one or two a year. And I'll have plenty of bucks. And you know what? When you're breeding deer, you're going to get bucks. You're going to get big bucks. You're going to have stuff to breed with, and you know, everything will be fine. But from a strategic standpoint, I'd like people to use male sex semen. Now, I know that's not what you were asking. So I'm gonna answer your question. Sex semen is every time you use a straw of male sex semen, we're potentially reducing the doe numbers in the overall population without using the cull method. So by doing so, you're shifting cost basis from the loss in revenue on a doe or doe sales, because that doe is not going to exist because you're not creating her, and you're shifting that cost basis from the cost of the semen, vet, etc., into a product, the male buck, that is going to give you revenue back, hopefully in the long run. So if you can figure out what your conception rate has to be, that's step one. We need to hit whatever, 62% on our male sex semen to make the cost of the semen and the vet costs, etc., to create that animal work out. Then you got to get the thing to weaning. And then we get into the normal animal husbandry part. The biggest thing that you can do on your farm is try to produce a buck that is worthy enough to collect your own sex semen and hopefully get a viable collection. Because the, you know, just in generally pricing out sex semen from guys, you're looking at $500+. Maybe you can find a couple that are under that. But as soon as your semen costs start going up, it doesn't make sense. Your conception has to go up so much. And I'm personally, I have not had the conception that warrants those higher prices in semen using male sex semen. Is that the question you were getting at, I think? Or
yeah, no, you were heading in, you know, I was making notes as you were first stating your personal biased opinion towards the, which is fine, which is great.
I think it was a good one.
And I guess I was looking at it as, and I'm kind of working this through my mind lately a little bit as well. So this conversation is selfish a little bit on my part. But I would argue, you know, what's the goals for your herd? Is kind of what you were getting at there. What is the goals for your herd? If you look at your females and you're like, I just want to produce bucks. And I would argue that there's, I would say there's likely producers out there that could care less about, not that they, maybe they don't realize it, but they could care less about progressing their female lines. Mm. They're saying, you know, here's my 10 females. I went to a producer like Josh or Joe Blow down the street who has another good genetic program, and I bought 8 or 10 does. So I want these does that were bred to perform in a certain way to give me bucks every year. So if you say, okay, I don't want any, my goal is, or in my mind as the producer, I don't need any replacement females. If one dies, maybe I'll go to the producer and I'll go find and buy another one. So my goal is to pump bucks out of this herd, which is fair, you know. Sure. So there's 20 does they have. They now need at least 20 straws of sex semen. To your point, you know, that could be 10 grand if they're purchasing it themselves. Yep. Hopefully they can get their own buck to produce that semen. But going back, what are your goals? If I don't need any replacement females, then I want to do completely all sex semen. You have to weigh your cost, to your point. You have to weigh your cost. You have to weigh your conception. Have you had good conception in the past? If not, you're just throwing money in the toilet.
Can you wean? Can you get?
Can you wean fawns? Yeah, what's your weaning? What, from the fawns that are born until they're weaned, and then from weaned until they're ready for market. Those are all, from the time they're born to the time they're ready for market, whatever that is for you, whether it's 1 year, 2 year, 3 years,
yeah,
or 6 months if you're maybe selling buck fawns. What is that? And then what are the costs associated with that? And I also would argue from a cost associated with that, if you only have 6 or 8 animals and you're looking for buck production, solely buck production, there's a good chance you're not going to have your own buck to be able to draw semen off of. Or maybe you're, you know, because you're not, there's a good chance. Let's just leave it at that. So, is it cheap? You know, then it might be cheaper to go buy 5 or 6 straws than it is to draw one single buck. Because I think I haven't drawn sex semen for a while. I think you're still at a minimum of 30.
Yeah, it's like 30,
3,500, 3,700 or something like that.
3,750.
Yeah. Up to 30 or up to, I don't know what it is anymore.
Yeah, I thought it was like a 25 straw, 20 straw or something like that. Yeah.
And then after that, it's a reduced rate per straw.
$1.50 or $1.25 per straw.
So you're gonna likely be anywhere between 150 to 300 and 400 bucks a straw, even producing it yourself.
Yeah, for sure.
So now, if you have a buck that can give you those 30, 40 straws, and then you can use those straws over a 3, 4, 5 year period, I'm not saying it couldn't make sense on a small herd.
It sure would be.
It could.
Yep.
So herd size would dictate whether you try and draw your own buck, if you have that buck, first of all, yep, or do you got to go purchase? Mm-hmm. Or my other, those are kind of the key points, I would argue. Would you not? You know, I think you need, if you're talking about raising better deer, but then again, the other side of your mouth, using a majority of sex semen. Well, if you're talking about raising better deer, but then using all sex semen, you don't know. I would argue I don't know what you're talking about, because you can't make better deer without females.
I think
that, I mean, it takes a male to breed, but yes, you're not building better females within your own herd to build better genetics without males. So, it's not to say, I think I'm looking at it as, can I take a herd of 40 females and then can I breed, does it make economical sense to your points of all this to breed 10 or 15 of those as sex semen and use the other 25 or 30 as my potential replacement, females that have the potential to create me replacement females in my herd for the betterment of my herd.
Let's have fun with this. If the does that you're breeding with the sex semen are good enough to produce you bucks that will give you the opportunity to collect sex semen from them in the future, why would they not be good enough to give you does to repopulate or to further your breeding program?
Because
hang on, wait. Are you to the point where you've said to yourself,
any doe on my farm that produces a buck, I am willing to breed with if he meets the criteria that I have in a deer from a pedigree standpoint. That's the question.
I'll state it again. So every doe on your farm, this is a goal for me personally.
Why not? And we're flip-flopping between recommendations for other guys and in our own personal.
So, which is fine.
Take from it what they can.
There's so many ways to skin this thing.
Yeah, there is. That's the point.
Okay, so you mentioned it. A guy, if they wanted to, could buy 50 does, breed them all to sex semen, right? He could buy 50 does and we'll call it a mega breeder buck, right? Like a big buck. He could breed them all to sex semen, and he could sell all the buck fawns for $2,000 a piece and make a living doing it every year. My question is that
make a profit doing it?
Yes. I mean, depending on what your standard of living is,
make the farm work.
Yeah.
Regardless.
I think that
potential livelihood. Yep. Sorry, I didn't mean to.
No, that's fine. The question is that fun? That's a real question.
Yeah, and that's
what I just
said. Individual to answer that. Yes.
But like, exactly. When I look at my farm, I have a personal sense of enjoyment based on how I have my farm set up. And the reason that I try to challenge myself with how I'm doing things, am I trying to achieve goals, which, by the way, I don't think there are goals with white-tailed deer. I think that's a mystical beast that can't be slayed, because I don't think there is ever a perfect deer. In your mind, there is. Right? So, but like, I want to make fawns. I want to watch bucks grow. I want to watch my does grow. I want to evaluate those animals as they grow in all aspects, physically, their temperament, etc. And then I want to make breedings that I think, or matchings, pairings it with genetics that will make me a better version of what I already have. To me, that's fun.
Sure.
Okay. So there's that. Is there a way to make money doing that? Yeah, it's just hard depending on your numbers. Like, you know, I think a lot of this comes down to numbers.
Yeah, numbers, regulation, what the market. I mean, there's so many components. Yeah. Especially what we're seeing in the state of Pennsylvania. That's why I'm trying to have this conversation, so people can start thinking about their own herds. What are the parameters you have to work within?
Right.
We're in this new, what we call, they call CCMZ, a captive core management zone. Is that right? Captive core management zone.
Sounds good.
Something
core
like that.
Core captive management zone.
So we have 80% or better of producers within this three county zone. They can't, I don't want to, in my opinion, they don't have a marketplace besides selling their bucks.
Correct. That's a fact.
In today's market, with where they're at.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I think there's going to need to be an adjustment for those producers on how they look at their facilities.
Mm.
That, plain and simple as that. And I do think it for their benefit, I would argue that more males is better. Just in a really general sense. How they look and how they do that.
You could have just said that from the beginning. We were talking about.
Well, no, I'm just I want.
Yeah,
we don't have the open border marketplace like we used to have,
right?
And it's shrinking every day, unfortunately. Until technology catches up, and for those who are listening, don't know what we're talking about. It's chronic wasting disease and the regulations that are attached to that.
Yep.
So I'm just saying, having these conversations. Hopefully, guys, if anyone listens to us, is just we got to change our way of thinking. And I think some guys that I've, just by listening to guys talk, looking at posts on social media, I get curious what they're doing. A lot of times it comes out as me being ignorant and being like, why are they doing that? But I'm not saying they don't have a reason. It just doesn't make sense to me of why they're doing what they may be doing. what I'm doing might not make sense to what they're doing. But I was having a conversation regarding sex semen, and it was just like, is there a place for it? I think there is, or there is at least a place for discussing, for a lot of our producers, specifically in Pennsylvania, and what we're talking about, to find ways to increase the percentage of males produced off your farm.
Yeah, if you look at that CCMZ, you know, the
do they become
the, the vision that I had kind of laid out and what I'm doing, it doesn't exist for them.
No, it doesn't.
Because if you get a semen quality, and let's just face it, like, the goal is to produce a buck that is a semen quality animal to as many other people as possible.
I don't agree with that.
Oh, no, but like that. So let me expand on that then.
We're having fun with this too. Yeah. But like,
so the reason is that, well, number one, it's an ability to produce the most amount of return in the shortest period of time based on the hard work that you've done on your farm.
As a whole, you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's the home run. That's the grand slam. There's certainly a measure of pride that could potentially play into that, where the sales vindicate your vision of breeding. And that is, you know, shown in the dollars that you receive for the semen.
Let's be clear, because our terminology in our industry sometimes gets confused. When you said sales, you just mean the sales that you made personally off your farm will dictate what you do with your program, not the sales in the sense of a sale catalog and an auction.
I knew
that's what you meant. Just clearing that
sales.
Up. Sales. I know. I just wanted to. You get a guy listening. I don't do sales. Yeah. No, you do sales. Your personal farm sales is what we're talking about. We always talk about auctions as sales.
That's not
all I meant by that.
That's not what I was.
I know you weren't.
Go ahead. Anyway, I lost.
I'll take you off track. Sorry.
I lost my train of thought. It's okay.
I was saying, disagree with every animal, whatever you said about every buck you're trying to produce should be a buck that's capable about semen. It's not exactly what you said, but that's.
No, I was saying that the goal is to produce a semen quality animal. Like, no one. I don't think I've ever met anyone that's a deer farmer that doesn't want to produce an absolutely stud buck. If that stud buck happens to generate semen sales, that's a good thing. I'm saying that's one of the main goals. I mean,
certainly.
Okay. That's
and
all.
I'm gonna get even more. I think a lot of guys. I'm going to say the exact same thing in a sense, but, you know, who doesn't have a goal of raising a buck that can produce them $1 million in semen sales?
Yeah.
Like, we all wish for that.
Sure.
But don't let your dreams get in the way of reality and what you can afford to do, can't afford to do. You know, don't keep losing your ass each year on the farm. I mean, if you want to and if you can afford to, but generally, don't want to keep losing our ass on the farm as a whole, because we're trying to buy. We've been there, but because you're trying to buy high-end semen of highly marketed bucks, whether they're worthy of it or not, is a different story. But buying these highly marketed bucks and highly productive bucks, in many cases as well, in your efforts to try and produce one of those bucks, because they are. It also takes more than just producing them to get that cash reward that you're looking for out of that semen. Okay. Marketing, blah, blah, blah.
Well, buying, there's nothing, I don't want to say there's nothing worse. Buying high-end semen and selling the offspring to the stocker market can be hard to stomach over time if you continually do that again and again.
So manage what you do if you are buying a high end semen. Maybe it's two straws with six does, and you have 40 does, or whatever.
If you're selling a buck and you're getting $4,000 for him, would you have rather produced him on your farm with one of your bucks, or would you rather have paid $5,000 for a straw semen? Well, I'll tell you which one I want, because I like to keep my inputs low.
Right.
So
yeah, it's all relative in a sense to each farmer, but not but there is no but.
Oh, good.
There is, back to the sex semen. I'm trying to finagle through my brain if there's
it's a
plate, if it's a tool that I can utilize on my farm effectively and efficiently. And I think guys can, but just to breed sex semen because you don't know what to do with the dauphins, that's not a good enough answer for me to why you're breeding sex semen. Well, it's a start to the discussion.
Yeah.
But it should be continued as, okay, what are your goals? Do you have, what's your favorite female lines on your farm? What, do you want more females out of that? Do you not have enough females out of that? Well, don't breed endosex semen. Let's look at these other girls. Maybe it's the does you started with 4 years ago. Now you got daughters, granddaughters, great-granddaughters, or whatever it is, two daughters out of her. And you're like, okay, I think these daughters are a little higher performing than her. So take her and breed her to sex semen. And then take those two other girls and try and replicate or build on them. So that's how I'm looking at it. Is there a place for these, you know, either maybe it's mistakes. And I don't mean mistakes in a bad way, but maybe a backup female. A female from a backup buck in my AI program. Maybe I take her as sex semen. I have the ability to do sex semen, put her on my hunting preserve, and build, you know, genetics that way.
You probably treat her bad.
No.
You're a backup.
She's a highly productive animal. She just doesn't meet. She may not. Yeah. She may not meet. Now, I'm keeping some females in my breeding herd out of what were backup bucks at the time that I used them as backups, and then yeah. They became a 3 and 4 year old. I'm like, oh yeah, I'm gonna work with this female.
Yeah.
But look at your herd, see where it fits in. Have you had history of success in your AI? These are all things we just said. I'm just kind of going over.
Yeah.
You know, if you increase your buck, here's another one. Going back to our original space, if you increase the percentage of bucks on your farm, do you have space to hold those bucks?
Got to get them. You got to get them to the final stage of sale in a healthy manner without lots of inputs. No, there's so many different opportunities within the market to do different things, and everybody's going to have a little different version of that, right?
Thankfully, yes.
Yeah, thankfully. No, it makes things really interesting. You could probably. Well, I think it's worthwhile to always continue to think deeper on you know, these types of things. So, like, you know, continue to reevaluate and reassess your operation is important. You know, there could be something there that you're missing that could bring in, you know, extra revenue or ultimately create a better environment for the animals or whatever that may be. And only by, you know, kind of having discussions about it and being open to thinking about doing something in a different way, will you find that?
Sure.
Yeah, I think that's very true.
I can keep going or we can wrap up.
Go ahead, man. Hit me.
I don't know. Sex semen. I don't know.
Embryos.
I've never done. Yes, embryos is another reproductive avenue tool
mm-hmm.
that you can use on your farm. I've never used them. I've listened to you and others discuss embryos, and I could see a benefit, but I'll let you. How do you see? What's the value in embryos, and how do you see them being utilized in programs?
Again, we just riffed for like 40 minutes on male sex semen and didn't answer anybody's questions, but we gave them a lot of things to think about.
That's what we're here for.
I think embryos.
We're not here to give you answers.
Yeah, I think embryos are similar. So when you look at a buck and his ability to influence a herd, and when I say a herd, I don't mean like maybe it's your 10 animals, but I mean, you know, the white-tailed deer herd in the country or whatever that is, right? He has the ability to add his genetics in one generation to hundreds and or thousands of deer in a single season. When guys have identified what they consider to be valuable or powerful or whatever type of adjective you want to attach in front of a female, that produce a certain thing, whatever that is that you're looking for. How do we expand that genetic influence in you know, a way like we can with the males for the females. And really the only tool that we have today is embryos, right? I look at embryos as a preservation mechanism for females, much like you would for a buck. You know, it simply preserves those genetics. We, you know, having to preserve genetics of a female through a male is limiting because 50%, you know, 50% of that is potentially a male that you may not have had influence over. So when you're right. when you're creating embryos, you get to pick the buck, right? That the offspring are out of. At this point, you could pick the sex if you so choose. And I think that it's probably worthwhile to have female embryos from some of your kind of core does if you're interested in having some kind of long-term program. I don't know what that looks like from a longevity standpoint. Like, I don't have a crystal ball where I could look at my program today. I haven't really thought about it and say I've identified, you know, three or four different does. Maybe they all, in my case, they probably all have very similar genetics. I've made embryos out of them, and, you know, mostly females, but maybe a few males. I've put them in the tank. What does that give me 20 years from now? I don't know. I haven't really thought about that. I'm still in. So I have a long-term vision, but I'm still in relatively speaking, short-term strategy mode, trying to develop my thoughts around assessing animals, evaluations of animals, so I know my selection is correct. That way, those animals that if I do choose to cryogenically freeze genetics, that I know they're going to be a certain way when they're born, right? I know they're going to have longevity, performance, that kind of thing. So I think it's an interesting concept, the embryo thing.
It is, and I was, as you were talking, I was trying to think, like, where how does this play out in the real world in the deer industry? And it has for many guys, and I don't know what their strategies were, what their models were, whatever that was. I wasn't familiar with that. So, but we've seen guys and heard of guys, you know, using embryos to get certain genetics out of parts of the country, out of the country, whatever that looks like. It's a way to get you a female or to get you an animal,
mm-hmm.
Without having to have the sire or the female. There, and you can get
yep.
that animal. So, you know, I start to think, and again, it's going to sound like we're hating on these big, giant non-typicals, and we do most of the time. But you look back, you can maybe pull out a doe, but just look back when we, maybe it was the 90s or early 2000s, and there was some really productive females that were more along the lines of the type of deer you and I are trying to produce, the classic big whitetails. Mostly typical type looking, you know, good looking deer. And
big non-typicals didn't exist back then.
Well, then they started to exist.
As much.
And then that female got bred to that giant non-typical.
Yeah.
That daughter got bred to that giant non-typical. That granddaughter then got bred to another giant non-typical. And that great-granddaughter got bred to another giant non-typical. And here's the sweet mom from 1999 who's now dead. And I'm sorry, but it's going to be hard to get her back through those offspring. Especially when you're 3-4 generations down. You're 20 years down the road, 30 years down the road. I can't see where you could foresee this for 20 years down the road. But I there's probably some females out there right now that you and I could look back and say, okay, I wish there was embryos out of that. So we could get her back. When I say get her back, get back to that foundation and take that deer in a better direction. I've bought does and felt, I'm not saying I did, but I took them in what I considered a better direction when I seen how they were bred to 3 years before I bought them.
Yeah.
And I did something different with them. I think there's value in that, but it's easy for me to say that now because we're 20 years down the road. You're like, oh, I wish I had, you know, a blue 37 or a yellow 66. You know, what I forget, was she a Maxwell daughter or was she? Or, you know, not saying what other guys have done with those animals is wrong, but could you go a different – I could see going a different avenue with those animals.
Well, the
– and not have to pay $90,000 for one of them.
Yeah, the tech – jeez.
Or whatever that is.
Sure. The technology in deer didn't exist.
Sure.
So that was a challenge. But it exists today. Right?
Correct.
So what is it today that we can do to preserve genetics for the long term?
Can I cut you off?
Yeah.
So like, and I don't know this stuff, and the guy's like, some.
I don't
like,
either.
So, but in other industries, when you look, this would be good to have Fred on, because he would probably slap us both around and say, yeah, here's what the reality is.
Fred ain't smacking me anyway.
I assume embryos is a much bigger discussion in, say, the cattle industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a discussion because they're making these jumps in genetics that they can calculate through, or their, I guess calculate's the right word, through EPDs.
Yep.
Expected progeny differences.
Yep.
So they can, they're being able to calculate all these differences and make these leaps and bounds in a sense. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but they're making these leaps and bounds of genetic traits that then, when you see that big leap and bound, it's like, oh man, it's one of the only, they're way ahead of us, so let's go buy 10 embryos, put them in our females, and we've just taken that jump in our herd through buying embryos, buying 20 embryos rather than going and buying 20 cows. And those donor cows now produce you calves that are, that have excelled for whatever the genetic reasoning is. What are those, I guess the challenge with the deer is what are those jumps in genetics that we are looking for today? And are they necessarily, it's not all just bigger is better. So for an embryo to be valuable to me, what kind of benefit are we looking for as producers today as a whole? Or there's no standard, so I guess we can't answer that. There's no standard of what kind of jump we're looking for in our genetics. Am I making sense? Like, to bring an embryo in, bring a bunch in because you've seen this line of animals do something that you're trying to get to, and you can get there a lot quicker than semen or this or that. What is that we're looking for?
When you were saying that, I was thinking about the conversation we just had about sex semen, and then how it could be used in so many different ways for so many different types of operations. So you look at the type of operation that you have, and are embryos a good fit, or what is the ROI of bringing in an embryo from a certain female line to your operation? Because I suspect that high quality embryos are expensive, thousands of dollars, and in some cases, if you could even get your hands on them,
right.
So, you know, there's that component, and then I look at the different, and obviously it's easy to look at cows and say, well, there's a black cow, and she's, you know, the female's built a certain way, the male's built a certain way, and they have these metrics through the EPDs.
I think you're using the word easy a little too loosely there. But yes, it's, you have a lot more data to look at with cows than we do deer.
Way more.
Yep.
And, easier.
Which could make it harder.
I meant easier.
Yeah.
But the trait that separates white-tailed deer is they have antlers, and there's inherent value in their trophy quality. Do you want to buy embryos from animals that are the same as what everybody else has? Because there's a
there's a value in the uniqueness of the white-tailed deer. Does that make sense?
It does. When you were talking, I'm looking downline. I'm looking the animals that start having fawns on a big, large hunting estate or hunting preserve. Okay. And how does that compare to the individual breeder trying to do its own thing to then downline down the road or down the line influence those herds? Yeah, there's always, I shouldn't say always, there seems to be connection between value and uniqueness of something,
Or scarcity.
Or scarcity, yes, or rarity of that, yeah, scarcity of that animal, exactly right. I guess your point is, I keep looking at it as like a genetic gain.
Those are going to come. We think that's a fact, right?
Sure.
So,
but what I guess for most, to your point of antlers, in history has shown us in the last 10 or 15 years, gains has only meant antler inches and increases of antler inches. Sorry, banging on the table. And maybe not for everyone, but yeah. In my mind, looking at the deer industry, we've proven that the gains meant bigger antlers. And a shorter period of time to get to those bigger antlers.
Sure.
I get that can be said from a 150-inch typical going to a 200-inch typical. It can be said for a 180-inch non-typical going to a 500-inch.
Whatever your calibration of measurement is.
So, I guess, are you looking for a specific gain in your herd? And can you use embryos through that? I guess that's the way I'm looking at it. But I think you're looking at it a little differently. That's what I'm trying to get on.
As far as genetic gain, you would have to, I think, have a good understanding of the genetic ability of your herd to produce a certain type of animal, and say that if you were going to incorporate embryos and or some type of semen, what is the genetic benefit to doing that? How will this influence the current genetics that you have, and what does that look like long term? Because, like, okay, I'll give you an example. So for me, I've done very little embryo work. We collected embryos, I think, 5 years ago. I just put them in recips this year. They sat there. And you know what I said to myself? Boy, I wish I would have used female semen.
Because
it was male semen that we did it with.
Oh, you didn't do it with the conventional. You did.
Okay. I used male semen to make these embryos. It's not a bad cross. It's a cross that I'm excited about.
Do you remember what your thinking was back then for the reason to put male sex in?
Because I was in the mindset that I needed to
get that buck at bucks.
I needed to get my buck numbers up. Yeah. So I was just going to do embryos and it was. It was the same time as the sex semen conversation that we had earlier started.
And I don't know if the economics makes sense in this, but just one thing I was thinking of, just brainstorming uses for embryos. I can see it being a tool to turn over a herd quicker than trying to breed something into your herd. I should go the opposite way because I feel like I've been picking on the non-typical.
It's 100% turnover.
It is. Well, it could be 100% turnover of your whole herd.
Genetically speaking, it's 100% turnover of every doe that an embryo goes in as a surrogate.
Yes, I'd imagine you're putting in.
Doesn't matter what you're putting in.
So a producer that, say, was raising all, I'm going to go opposite here to be fair, all typicals.
We know this isn't real, Jared.
All right, you hear guys a lot. It seems to be a trend where guys want to raise more typicals now because the marketplace...
Cleaning up their herds.
So, I would say some does are beyond cleaning completely up. Doesn't mean you can't throw cleaner deer into them and still get big framey non-typicals that look better. I surely think you can do that. Mm-hmm. But if you're truly saying, I don't have any females in my herd that can produce me a 100, let's use 190-inch typical 5x5. I don't have any does that can do that. So Josh has embryos out of certain crosses that, you know, when them females hit the ground, they have a capability to start putting you 190, 200-inch typicals. Typical frame deer on the ground. Would embryos would be the quickest way to get to that route, besides buying the female herself. But in today's marketplace,
it's faster than buying the female herself. If you buy a female and she's not flushed, right? You only get one set of offspring. You gotta wait to get embryos out of her. If you buy her embryos, you could put them in a whole pile of does at your place.
Sure, you're saying embryos now, yeah. Yep. But still, yes.
Okay, sorry.
It could be a tool to turn over a herd to get you to trace that you don't have in your herd right now and get there much quicker. The economics, I don't know. I don't know what semen's called. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what embryos calls it. You know, that's a different. But from a general standpoint, you could use those embryos to get you a herd of 5 or 6 or 10 or 20, whatever your numbers are dictating or what you want, to turn over and completely replace your herd with different animals by utilizing the animals you already have in your herd. As donor females.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like.
I was just brainstorming a way it could be used because I never really thought about embryos and how I could utilize them.
Yeah, I see. I think there's a couple things, and you touched on it. The ability to move genetics into areas that don't allow live animal import, export, whatever you want to look at it. That's one. For me, it's just the ability to transfer female genetics through time. That's the simplest way that I look at it.
Yep.
And you can do whatever you want with it when you have it. Right? The embryos.
Sure. If you don't have it, you can't do anything with it.
Yeah.
Same.
But like preservation of female genetics. It's interesting. I think at this point, from what I've seen, and it's so hard because, like, we don't disclose in our industry if they're embryo babies or not, which is weird to me. Like, if I'm buying something, just tell me it's ET. It's not a big deal. Just tell me. Now, for me, it may change my mind. I don't know.
Can I dig deeper into that statement? Why? Why do you care if it is or not?
Because I believe that there's value in scarcity. I believe there's value in uniqueness. I also, you know, you talked about not selling your does for a few hundred bucks to somebody else to use. There you go.
Devaluing that female.
Right.
I think you're still talking about it. Yeah, we can go deeper in that.
Yeah. I also, if I know it's an ET, and I know that there's other sisters or brothers, from a good breeder's perspective, I need to make sure that I keep an eye on those because there might be potential genetics that I want to incorporate into my animals.
Right.
So, but I think the biggest thing for me is the scarcity part. I think it has value. And again, those other offspring out of the embryo transfers are tools for me to use.
I still think the scarcity comment could be, I hear that and I automatically think you're discussing in a breeding sales world or a mindset based on selling the genetics of that product.
Yep.
And how much, again, I'm not disagreeing with it. I agree with you to an extent. But, you know, if I'm in a closed state and the competition was within my state, and I know that, you know, again, you would have to know this. 10 went to Texas. Well, I don't care. Those guys don't compete with me up here in the North Market. I don't care if there's 100 million of them down there. If I'm using it to just increase the quality of my production for my own purposes,
sure.
Then it doesn't, I could care less. And hopefully that's the case so I can get it a lot cheaper.
How do you know today
I'm not
going to be the same as
2 years from now or 10 years from now or 30 years from now as far as closed states or...
Well, I guess then I don't. And, right. But for it to matter, then I guess I... then if my... I'm not saying that 10 years down the road, I'm not, if the markets open up, I'm not going to want to play a part in those markets. Mm-hmm. My business model is not set up today to play into those markets. North it's North. To create the better deer that I can, keep records of my genetics, keep records of who my animals are. And if that happens, it happens. Right. I'm still trying to create a better animal. Don't get me wrong.
Yep.
That's my goals. Better animal, but also I'll leave it at better animal.
Yep.
But I don't. I guess I'm not making a whole lot of decisions relying on those markets to open back up because I don't see them opening back up anytime soon. But
so
hopefully they do. Obviously, yeah. Obviously.
So.
Just that was just devil's advocate.
Like, yeah. I agree.
If we're all competing in the same market,
yeah.
Which I don't believe we are
no.
in today's deer industry, we're not all competing in the same market.
No.
It's a different story.
Well, there's many different markets too, which is good, right? Some of them are maybe artificial. Some are created through regulation.
Yes, exactly.
Whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But what I look at when I look at genetics, kind of big picture, I look at those as a way, or not maybe not as a way. I look at those on a long-term time horizon. So I believe that the work that we do today with our animals could, depending if we do a good job, could and most likely will be seen in 50 or 100 years from now. So I'll give you one example. Dogs. Let me give you two examples. Racehorses. So both dogs and racehorses.
Both books you have not let me borrow yet either.
I'm not going to let you borrow. These two breeds have been tracked in so many different ways for hundreds of years, right? The knowledge that is gained through the record keeping and potentially you looking at it has value to the kind of discerning individual. I hope that our industry is here in 100 years. I want to be a part of that after I'm dead.
You want your genetics to be a part of that after they're done. Genetics, you created a line of deer that you created. I 100% respect that. And I would say, just for the people listening, to not... I don't care if I am. Let's put it that way. Let's just talk about it this way. I don't care if I'm part of the genetics components of this in 100 years. The only way I care about it is if I do have kids or someone, our descendants of us, that we, you know, a legacy is built through a family of continuing these operations. But for the, just as those dog and horse producers that you were mentioning, mm-hmm. They were a minority in the scheme of dog breeders and horse breeders across the world at that point. Right. I would argue they were a minority in the focus and dedication they have to their animals. I would argue what you're explaining you want to do and what you are doing is in the extreme minorities within the deer breeders today of the people that are dedicated and focused to doing that. Doesn't make what they're doing wrong. It's just different.
Yeah.
And it's an admirable goal for you to have, and it makes sense. Just people listening can't get confused and think that everybody, number one, can be that because they can't. That's just numbers would prove that, and they can try. But not every program needs to be set up to be what I'm again calling the seed stock producer that produces these traits in these animals that you want to pass on to different herds and new generations of animals. Yeah. And again, they don't have to. I'm just playing devil's advocate on people listening that, you know, that doesn't have to be the reason you raise deer, but it is going to be the reason we have better deer in the future.
I agree. Yeah. I think that's well put.
And I hope you keep doing it so I can utilize those genetics in the future.
I hope that I know that there's others that have similar thought process to what we're talking about, and I'm always encouraged to have discussions with them about deer and genetics, because that's how we learn from each other.
Right.
You know, I think there's kind of three platforms that make us better at what we do. One is time or experience. The other one is dedication or ambition. Those two are kind of, I think, intertwined towards creating a better deer. And then the third is learning from others, or the pursuit of knowledge.
Yep.
And I think that we, in some aspects, I think that we've lost a lot of that ability for people to search for those truths in today's world, because we can simply type something into a supercomputer that we held in our hands and we can have an answer. And there's not anything beyond that. It's a lot of short-term, low time preference kind of looks at things. You know, what can I do tomorrow to make $10,000, right? Okay, great. There's nothing wrong with
that. What can I do today to make $10,000 tomorrow?
Right.
Now, what can I do to be in the same business making $10,000 for the next 50 years?
That's exactly right. And I think I think that long-term look at the deer industry is something that's really important. And you know, a two-hour bender like we just had, I think, you know, goes to show that there's so much that we don't know and that we need to keep exploring.
And again, to your point, they're looking at other industries, looking at other management strategies with other industries, and there's knowledge to be gained within our industry for sure, but through individuals and experience and all that. But don't be afraid to look outside the box. Look outside into other agricultural sectors to find that education you might be looking for. You know, the Deer Farmers Facebook page is not going to have all your answers. It'll help you, but I think we ended it kind of last time too. But just try. It's a challenge. I think we both face it. Try to understand. Think about everything, the farm as a whole. You know, a macro view of what you're trying to do, and then you can start breaking down your management strategies, maybe into these micro discussions, whether it's soil health on your farm, whether it's your genetic management, whether it's your fawn protocol for your fawns born in the
spring.
Should I
clip apple branches and put them in?
Yeah,
then?
Right.
That's where we started.
Right. Do your deer seem happier? Then let them be happier.
Right.
But also know what you want to do. Try to stick with it the best you can and do best by your animals and make it fun. Don't make it, we've been through periods of time, both of us, I know, and a lot of it had to do with politics. That it wasn't fun doing what we were doing. It wasn't because of our deer and whatnot, it was because of politics, but it should be fun. And if it's not fun, again, that's, you know, dad's gonna love hearing that. It should be fun. You gotta make money, you know, but know where your place is and what is the best way that you can manage a deer herd to contribute and make an income or proportional income.
Mm-hmm.
I'll stop because, yeah.
So I think that's a good place for us to wrap up. We had a really wide-ranging discussion today. I appreciate you taking the time to sit down with me and have a good conversation. If you guys enjoy the work that we do here on the podcast, make sure that you tell other people about it. And if you would like to financially support it, head over to the Servant Solutions page and sign up for the membership program. And with that, we'll wrap up. And as always, stay tuned for another episode of North American Deer Talk.
Bye.